John chapter 8.
Uhuru
was the cry that rent asunder many of the East African nations in the 50s and 60s. It's a word of freedom. And for people who were oppressed, it was a very emotional word. It somehow caught up all their dreams and aspirations. And although it led to a great bloodshed, it did finally lead for them to a freedom from colonial oppression. People are still oppressed throughout the world, in Africa, indeed in some of those very countries in which they fought off the colonialists. They have successively fought off other dictators. They're oppressed in Asia, in Europe, in the Americas, anywhere you want to go. And the cry for freedom is still a powerful shout. It is still one that draws people's attention. It still has the emotive pull that can gather together people to fight a common cause. Whether we see them today in national liberation fronts, of which, of course, the word liberation is just another word for freedom, or whether we see it in certain social movements within our own society, from women's liberation to gay liberation, the idea of liberty, of freedom, is an ideal for which most people aspire. But freedom is very hard to define. And it's very hard to find. We know its opposite. We know slavery. We can feel it. That is very clear. But yet we do not always perceive our slavery. We do not always see when we are in slavery, such as the slavery we have to our own culture. When we cross a cultural barrier, we suddenly realise all the kinds of things that we've been taking for granted for so many years, never questioned, because everybody else in our community has taken them for granted. And it's only as we move into other communities with other cultures that we suddenly realise what slavery we have been in towards our own culture. Or, of course, there is the subtle economic slavery that we may be in, whereby we cannot help but work, and work for certain companies. Whether we want their goods or not, the whole society can be so structured that we will have to work for their goods, be it the General Motors or the telecommunication or whoever it may be. And we do not always leave our slavery in order to find a real freedom. We often leave one slavery only to enter into an alternative slavery. You may not have felt this way about the circumstances of your life, but for many of us, we left the slavery of home to go to school, only to leave that slavery to go to uni, only to leave that slavery to go to work, only to leave that slavery to go to retirement, only to leave that slavery to go to the grave. But we really have made several changes, and each of them, when we're on the brink of going, promised us new and great freedoms. But each of them we were glad to leave when we finished, because they provided us with just as much confinement as the one we had previously been in. It's very hard to leave slavery. And today, within our own society, there is a slavery which is called permission. It's a deceptive form of slavery. It's a very popular form. But it locks you and I into the most tyrannical of all slaveries. It locks us into the slavery of ourselves. And who worse to serve than yourself? For now you are permitted to do what you want to do. That sounds ultimate freedom. But it means really servitude to self. It means self-indulgence. Self-interest, selfishness. It makes me God over me. And that is a rather detestable thought, for I know myself of old. When we come to John chapter 8, Jesus makes many of the claims that he's been making in the previous chapters. And I'm going to ask you to volunteer some of the information so as to keep our minds well and truly alert. But I wonder, Philip, I wonder if you'd shut that door there, because I suspect the draft is coming through, and I've started off with a cold, and I'm sure others will pick it up if we leave that draft going. Is that right? Anyone suffocating? Anybody cold? Anybody not cold? All right. Just know who to sit next to next time, that's all. Thank you, Philip. Well, now, Jesus makes his claims in this chapter in contrast to the Jews. He says, you do these things, but I can do these things. You can't do the things that I do. And throughout this chapter, there is this contrast between himself and the Jews. They neither know where they've come from or where they're going to. But he knows both where he's come from and where he's going to. He is different from them in every respect. They will die in their sin. And unless they turn to him, they will die in their sin. He is going where they do not know. And they, rather ironically, when they raise him up, when they lift up the Son of Man, then they will know who he is. We, of course, know how in John's Gospel the Son of Man will be lifted up. That means when you kill me, then you'll know who I am. They really are in complete ignorance and quite unlike himself. He has two witnesses to who he is, his own words, and that the witness that is borne by his father. And on the evidence of two witnesses, he should be believed according to Jewish law. Well now, let us not spend great times in silence. Look for the answers quickly and tell me, from where, according to John's Gospel, chapter 8, from where does Jesus come? Jesus comes from heaven. That marks him off as different. Verse 18 tells us what about Jesus coming from where? Comes from the Father. That's right. He doesn't act independently. His message and ministry comes from his Father. That's repeated over and again in this chapter, isn't it? Yes, where else? From his Father, from heaven. I think they're the basic ideas that come out. They'll be expressed differently, won't they? It also talks about coming from the one who sent me, he who sent me. But we know that is the Father, for he equates those two en route. So Jesus comes from above, from heaven, sent by his Father to do his Father's work. Where is he going? Yeah, you've got to make an interpretive guess here, don't you? Because it doesn't say it. For in John's Gospel, Jesus' ascension and Jesus' crucifixion are equated. That you will see the Son of Man raised up, and he will draw all men to himself. And that he is talking about is his death. We would kind of expect at the time when he goes up in the cloud in Acts chapter 1. But to John, the crucifixion is not kind of separated off from the resurrection and the ascension and the rest of it. It all gets caught up in the one central act of Jesus. And the fact that in being crucified he is lifted up is symbolic of what is actually happening to him in his death. For he who is being low and humbled is actually being exalted very high. So I suspect it's both. They will not be coming where he is, though, for they cannot go the way of the cross as he does, and certainly cannot go to the Father as he does. Rather, where are they going? To death? Just not any death, but it actually talks about them going to die in their sins in that two occasions. Well then, what is Jesus doing? What is Jesus doing? He declares the message he has from the one who sent him. He does not speak of his own authority, he speaks of the authority of his Father. He does not give his own message, he gives the message that was given to him. He is one who passes on the message given to him. That's an important thing to remember when we consider chapter 17 and talk about the relationship between Jesus and his disciples sometime during 1979. It takes us a long time to get through John's Gospel. Now, what else is he doing? He judges, yet he doesn't judge. Where can you find those? 15 and 16. Right. So Jesus is very strange on the subject of judgment. He says, I come not into this world to judge the world. God sent the Son into the world not to condemn the world, well, that's the word to judge, not to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. That is, the ministry of Jesus is a ministry of salvation, not condemnation, not judgment in that sense. But yet, when you go to chapter 5, you find he is the judge. Judgment has been given to him. Verse 27, and has given authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming when all who hear the tombs will hear his voice. Come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. The judgment is committed to Jesus. He is the one who doesn't judge and yet does judge. And if he does judge, his judgments are true. They seem to be running around in circles at that stage, isn't it? The basic ministry of Jesus in this occasion is for salvation. But yet, such is the nature of his salvation that by him, men will be judged. For as they fail to respond appropriately to him, so they live in condemnation. He hasn't come for that purpose, but that is the byproduct of his coming. And that judgment is a true judgment. What else is Jesus doing? Setting men free. Which verse will you give that for? And you will know the truth, verse 32, and the truth will make you free. And verse 36, so if the Son of Man makes you free, you will be free indeed. Verse 29, isn't it? He who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do what is pleasing to him. Very often we express the sinlessness of Jesus in negative terms only. He committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. But it's not just that Jesus failed to sin, but Jesus positively did that which was right. He always did that which was pleasing to his Father. And that is why he was in perfect fellowship with his Father. There is nothing to separate Jesus from the Father, for he has not sinned as you and I have sinned, and so lives in perfect relationship and unity with his Father. Lovely verse, verse 29. For a testimony to the character and person of Jesus. It's well worth remembering. Yes, what else about Jesus is he doing? He gives light to the world, doesn't he? He bears testimony to himself. That testimony that he is the light of the world. He saves people. Verse 30, as he spoke thus, many believed in him. Did he do that or did they do that? I said, yes, all right. Because of the manner of his speech, people believed in him. These are the kinds of things Jesus is doing. All right, let's turn to the next one. How are we to judge him? According to witnesses, yes, and the witnesses he's given are two as according to the law, and so he is safeguarded. We're not to judge him, yes? Which part are you thinking of in that term? Last week, yes, those who judge, where is it? Chapter 7, verse 24, do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. But where is the difficulty for a sinful person in judging with right judgment? Yes, well, what in chapter 8 makes him particularly and peculiarly unable? Where do you see it in chapter 8? Verse 47, he who is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God. That is right. You see, we are biased observers. If we're not of God, we will not acknowledge God. We do not want God, and we will always be avoiding God. There's another passage I had in mind, actually. That whole passage about not knowing where he's come from and where he's going, which I think in some ways is summed up when it says in verse 23, he said to them, you are from below, I am from above. You are of this world, and I am not of this world. That makes us very hard for us to be able to evaluate Jesus. For what categories do we have by which we can make assessment? Well, he alone comes from the other world, and we come from this. Fifthly, what will he do? Promises can you see in this passage that tell you what he will be doing and what he will do for people? 51, was it? Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. There is a promise from God and from Jesus, isn't it? That if you keep his word, you will not taste death, but be seen to be in life. Right? What else? Verse 12, the light of life will come to those who follow him. Verse 31, he liberates his disciples. Doesn't liberate all men, he liberates his disciples, doesn't he? It's actually 31, 32. If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And verse 36, so if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed. So he liberates people. They seem to me to be the chief things, really. He makes one other claim than we have really mentioned so far, and in a sense, it is the most extraordinary claim he has made thus far. Verse 58, Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. That really is some claim. It claims to be older than Abraham, just in its straight grammatical reading, which is considerably clever, considering Abraham was dead roughly 1,700 years at that stage. And Jesus, as they point out, is not yet 50. So it really is talking about some kind of pre-existence. He's claiming at least that, but he's actually claiming more than that. For the word I am, or the phrase I am, is an emphatic phrase, which was quite unnecessary to convey that meaning. He has chosen a peculiarly emphatic phrase, the one that in the Greek Old Testament translated the name of God, back in Exodus, where God called himself I am who I am. That word, those words, are the ones that Jesus now says of himself. Before Abraham was, I am. I do not think you can finally nail a Jehovah's Witness on that verse, for they will be able to say he wasn't declaring that he himself lived before Abraham, but just that I am was living before Abraham. However, by the context of it, that interpretation is absurd. For what he is talking about is that he, though 50, Abraham could rejoice to see his day. And when they challenge him about it, how could that be? That is his defense. He's not talking about God, he's talking about himself. And that is clearly how the Jews understood him. Because what their reaction was to pick up stones and chuck them at him. There's no doubt as to what they thought he was saying. And I think there should be very little doubt as to what we think he should be saying at this stage. This is one of those testimonies that Jesus claimed divinity. Well, now there are Jesus claims, and they're extraordinary. You'll notice that there are varying responses to those claims, but before we pursue them, are there any questions you want to make about the chapter? We haven't followed it through by its logic. We've just been looking at these five topics, which I may add are the same topics we looked at last week in chapter 7. Verse 41, you do what your father did. They said to him, we were not born of fornication. We have one father, even God. That it? Well, it has been suggested, and you've got some argument for it too, that they're actually having a dig at Jesus, whose own parentage was so questionable. And that may have been known, and they may have been having a dig at him. But it need not be that. It may be no more than they feel that Jesus is suggesting that Abraham is not their father, that they are somehow bastard children of Israel. And they're saying, oh, no, it's not the case. We're not born out of wedlock. We've been born of the true nation of Israel, and if Abraham's not our father, then God himself is. Both suggestions, of course, could be true. Not contradictories. Philip? In what sense did your father Abraham rejoice when he was see my day and he saw it and was glad? Well, I'll give you the alternatives. Well, some of them. In that Jesus is the seed of Abram, so that on hearing of the promise to that he will have a great nation and through him all the nations will be blessed, Abraham was glad, but he didn't even know Jesus. But I would think that would be inadequate for the context. And I presume that is actually indicating that Abram, presumably out of his own lifetime and in the next world, actually saw the day of Jesus and was glad. But I do not want to push that into some kind of theology of what the afterlife of Abraham is. You know, you really would be building your whole case on very weak evidence at that stage. You might like to consider the passage in 1 Peter 1 verses 10 to 12 about the prophets looking into and longing for that day of Christ that was coming. However, I suspect that will be explaining one difficult passage by another. 1 Peter 1, 10 to 12. Well then, let's press on, shall we? I'm sure you can tie me in knots if you work at it long enough, if you haven't done it already. Within this chapter, you see that there's again a variety of responses. Sorry, would you like to stand up and sit down? Yeah, there you go. Just helps the circulation briefly, doesn't it? Of course, those who have got good padding, they don't need to. Suddenly all kinds of people jump up. All kinds of responses, but really in this chapter they're nearly all negative responses. The initial response, Jesus makes this great claim, I am the light of the world, and they want to challenge him. thinking they have snared him at last on his own words, hoisted on his own petard, as the saying goes, which most of us don't understand anyway. Then comes surprisingly in verse 30, and I think it is surprising as you read the chapter, that as he spoke thus, many believed in him. It is surprising because the logic he is using in verses 27, 28, 29 would not seem to us to be so commendable that people would now suddenly change their mind and become believers. But yet, as Linda has pointed out, there is something about what he is saying that has led people now to believe in him. Yet from our readings in John's Gospel, that should make us suspicious. Where does that suspicion start from in John's Gospel? Let's just keep our minds working here. Where in John's Gospel do you first see suspicion about belief? End of chapter 2 is suggested. Verse 23. Now, sorry, I'll give you time to get there. 2:23. Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did, but Jesus did not trust himself to them, verse 25, because he knew all men and indeed need no one to bear witness of man, for he himself knew what was in man. See, people who are believers, but yet he won't trust himself to them because he knows although they're believers, they're not true. Now that kind of theme has come through several times in the chapters in John's Gospel. And of course it's a great problem to us because what is Jesus calling upon us to do throughout the Gospel but believe? And yet when you keep on reading about people who are believers, you get second warnings that these people are not for real. Now here are people who are believers. But as the chapter goes on to show, they are really unbelievers. 4 verse 31, Jesus then said to the Jews who had believed in him, if you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples and the truth will make you free. And they answer him, we're descendants of Abraham. We've never been in bondage to anyone. How is it that you say you will be made free? Jesus answered them. He's still talking to the believers. Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not continue in the house forever. The son continues forever. So if the Son of Man makes you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are descendants of Abraham. I know that you are descendants of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me. These are the believers, the ones who seek to kill him, because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen in my Father, and you do what you have heard from your father. They answered him, Abraham is our father. That is the very ones that Jesus winds up challenging as being the sons of the devil and who throw stones at him are the ones back in verse 30 who are called those who believed in him. Now that is an interesting thing, isn't it? That belief and unbelief can be so caught up together. Notice verse 46. Which of you convicts me of sin? I tell the truth. Why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears the word of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God. The Jews answered him, are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? Couldn't think of any more insulting terms to find, you see. Now, what is it that actually sparks this off? The turn comes in verse 31 and the subject, which is actually develops a new theme, that is the subject of freedom, from which I started this evening and to which we return now. Jesus says, if you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. The little word abide, which you find in our John's Gospel and also in the first epistle of John, the word abide is the word continue. It's go on, remain. That is what the word means. We tend to use the word abide in a mystical sense. That is, to live in. But that's not how the word is used as far as I can see in the New Testament. The word does mean to live in something. If you abide in a house, you live in it. But the inness is not what is important. The continuing is what is important. I go on living there. That is what is important. That we must abide in Jesus does not mean that we're somehow mystically absorbed up into Jesus, but that we must continue being the disciples of Jesus. And as Jesus abides in me, the emphasis is not upon the inness in me, that Jesus is somewhere in my blood pump, but rather that Jesus continues with me in my fellowship, in my life as I walk through. And the RSV, quite rightly at this point, just uses the word continue. which many other translations will say, abide. If you continue in my word, that is, you continue to listen and pay heed to what I am saying, then you will be my disciples. See, these people have heard the words of Jesus and they believed. That is great. That is commendable. Jesus says, don't stop believing. Indeed, you must go on believing. For it is the one who goes on believing who is my disciple, not the one who just hears my word and initially responds. Let's change Gospels, and who can think of a passage in any of the other Gospels that would illustrate that point? John 14, I want to change Gospels though, Diane. That's alright. Can we pick another Gospel and think of a passage? You all know it. There's not a person in this room that doesn't know this passage. Yeah, the sower and the seed, the parable of the sower, isn't it? Right? The sower goes out, he throws the seed on the ground. Some of it, like on the rock, I suppose in a sense you could say, never gets in. But there are two other kinds of soil to which it does get in, aren't there? The shallow soil and the soil that's full of thorns. The word is actually received. But they are not his disciples. They flourish forth. Great growth comes and the sun comes out and it withers away. They grow up in amongst all the thorns and slowly are choked off. No longer to be there. Many, many people will hear the word of God in the words of Jesus and say, yes, that's marvellous. I want to be in on that. But they are not his disciples. If you continue in my word, you are my disciple. And one of the tests of the true disciple of Jesus Christ is that they will go on being the disciple of Jesus Christ. They will continue being the disciple of Jesus Christ. That's an important thing to remember in lots of areas of just a practical note, if I'll just distract the subject for a few moments. Paul says to Timothy that you're not to appoint as an elder someone who's a recent convert, for then he will be easily snared by the devil, because he'll be puffed up, etc. Now, it's very easy. A person comes into a fellowship group that you're running, into a Sunday school, into a church you're running, a Sunday school and so forth, and they make some profession of faith in Jesus Christ, and you slap them straight into leadership and say, this is the man we've been waiting for. He can do this, 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 this. He's got all these gifts and characters. He'll be able to lead the ship. And he will. Right out of the kingdom, usually. And a man makes a speedy response to the word of God. Praise the Lord, that's marvellous. But that he continues in the word of God, that is the testimony that he is a true disciple. You do understand, don't you, that I want people to respond to the word. I want people to believe in the word. I want people even to make snap decisions, if it's the right decision. I want people to become Christians and make that response, that initial response. That is marvellous. But it is the person who continues who is the true disciple. That is only the beginning. And so much of our evangelism, of course, is affected in this matter too, isn't it? That we will put such tremendous emphasis upon somebody making the first step. And that's a right thing. People do need to make that first step. It's a good and appropriate and a proper thing. But yet, it is the person who goes on who is the disciple of Jesus. And he, the disciple of Jesus, is the one who will know the truth. And it is the truth that he knows in the gospel of Jesus Christ that will liberate him. That will truly free him. Do you see again that the disciple is the one who will come to know truth? What does the word disciple mean normally in the language in which we're dealing with here? That is, if you take away the religious connotations of disciple, because it wasn't a particularly religious word, what does the word disciple mean? Pardon? Pupil. That's right, a student. What English word can you think of that will show you that? A discipline. That's right. It's not just the discipline of getting out of bed in the mornings, but the discipline you might be studying. You see, you can call mathematics a discipline. Some of us can call it a very strict discipline. A disciple is one who is a learner, a student. And as he studies and learns, so he comes to know the truth. The disciple of Jesus will come to know the truth. And the truth he knows will liberate him. Important to see the value here of understanding the gospel properly. For the disciple who continues in Jesus will continue to grow in a knowledge and understanding of the truth, and therefore will be made free. Now that message is the one which these people who believed in Jesus found so objectionable. You mustn't be calling us slaves. We don't need to be liberated. We are free men. We've never been in bondage to anybody. I would think that is one of the most incredible statements in the Bible. Where do we start? Back in Egypt? Because they're in bondage there, aren't they? We press on through. Which one do we want to? I mean, at the very time they say it, they're under the bondage of Rome. And they've had a good 10 different people who have captured them in between Egypt and Rome. These people have almost lived under no other circumstances of life but under bondage. So, oh, no, no, we're Abram's children. We're free men through and through. We have been in bondage to nobody. But Jesus is not talking of political bondage. And he could well point out the stupidity of that statement, but he doesn't, because that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about another bondage altogether. A bondage which actually is the bondage to sin. For the truth that he is speaking of is not opposite to error, or sorry, it's not opposite to ignorance, but rather the opposite of error. Error of life, as it is the truth of life that he is speaking of. Error in terms of our whole way of life. And he says that they truly are in bondage because they have sinned. And anyone who sins is in bondage. I have done a little experiment with our congregation so many times that I daren't do it again tonight. But I will remind those of you who have been here before of our previous experiments about the inability of our congregation to tell the truth. That although they all wish to tell the truth, they are self-confessed liars. If you're a visitor amongst us, and you may not have known that is the case, but let me assure you, you are in a group of self-confessed liars. Everybody in our congregation has confessed it on previous occasions several times as I've run this same experiment over and over. If you're a new person amongst us, you might like to try it out and testify to us that you always tell the truth. However, we know you and we suspect that you don't. You might say, how do we know you? How can I know? I'm just a visitor. I've only just arrived tonight. I haven't had an opportunity to tell a lie. Well, you get up and tell us that you always tell the truth, and there's your opportunity, isn't it? You have just succeeded in telling one of the greatest lies of all time. We are all caught up in that. We have all done that which is wrong. We have all told lies. And yet that is not what we want to do. We actually want to tell the truth. But we tell lies. That doesn't sound like we're in control of ourselves, does it? I mean, if a man wants to do something but constantly does that which is opposite to what he wants to do, it sounds like he's lost control of himself, doesn't it? Or it sounds like somebody else is in control of him. For if he is in control of himself, why can't he do what he wants to do? And why does he keep on doing the thing that he doesn't want to do? Sin is a terrible bondage, and Jesus can rightly pinpoint the very state of humanity, that we are in bondage to sin. Anyone who sins is in bondage. You can come and check me out later on that if you disagree with that assessment of your truth-telling capacities. So Jesus will pick this bondage. And the Jews are equally offended, if not more offended, and they say, all right, we do the things that Abraham did. We are Abraham's children, not in bondage to anyone. Jesus says, no, no, no. If you're Abraham's children, what is important is not that you've got the same genetic code that he had. I mean, that's not the thing that matters. Are you doing the things that Abraham did? No, I tell you, you're not. For, as you remember from our passage the night that was read to us in Genesis 15, God spoke to Abraham. Abraham believed God. God counted it to him as righteousness. These people, he said, you're not believing God, he says. You're not believing God's word. I'm declaring God's word and you reject it. You want to kill me. That's not what Abraham did. So they change grounds and they say, well, we may not do the things that Abraham did. However, we have God as our father. He says, oh, no, no, you've got a father all right, but your father's the devil. Now, up to this stage, the conversation may have been reasonably polite, but at that point, I have not the slightest shadow of a doubt that there was a certain degree of unsatisfactory emotional interaction. For they really at this stage have just been insulted so clearly that they can understand that that is what has happened to them. They may have missed the point previously, but there is very little doubt now. For Jesus says, any lie comes from the father of lies, and the devil is the father of lies. So if you're a liar, then your father is the devil, not God, for God is truth. And if you are the Son of God, then truth is the thing you will stand by, not lies. Well, they really do not argue the point anymore. They just blackguard him. You're a Samaritan. You're a demon. I mean, we might say, you're a Victorian. You play Aussie rules or something like that. You know, it had that kind of attitude to it. Yes, Peter? Hang on, if I don't come back to it, please. All right? I'm not quite sure at this stage whether that really does cover it, what I'm going to say. Now, here is the real point of our bondage. It is the bondage of deceit. And it is a terrifying bondage, because what it actually means is that we live a lie. We live a life that is deceit. We live a life of unreality. We do not face life as it really is, but concoct it to what we want it to be, or wanted it to be. Let me give you a short parable. It's one of my own devising. It's a parable of sin. My son and I play dominoes from time to time. We bought for him, as all novice parents do, a toy which was of no value. It was a set of picture dominoes. By the time you're old enough to understand the game dominoes, you're old enough to count. So you don't have to have picture dominoes, you could have had the number dominoes in the first place. If you're going to be a father, don't buy those picture dominoes. We've got a set that you can use just as easily as we can. Valueless. Get the number ones right from the word go. Anyway, I've got this game of dominoes. And Matthew, and always very keen to play with me on the subject of dominoes, and will bring them out often that we might play. And I say to him, all right, mate, here are the rules. This is how you play the game. And he says to me, as he is wont, I've got better rules to play than you have. I say, well, they're not my rules. I'm handing on to you an oral tradition that runs back many, many years. I've been playing dominoes since I was your age, and I was taught, and my father was taught, and this is the way you play dominoes. And he said, no. This is the way you play dominoes. And I said, all right, well, you tell me your rules, son. And so he then sets to and tells me his rules. Well, he's not very clear on his grammatical constructions, and given a father like he has, that's not surprising. His sentences go on and on and on. And the rules become more and more complex, and indeed I find there is a fair degree of lateral thinking running through his domino game. When I set to try and play his game of dominoes, there is no way in this world we can agree upon any point of the rules, other than that he wins in the end. It is the most extraordinary concoction of ideas by which he thinks he will be able to avoid the possibility of defeat, which he knows stands by my rules. Now that, to me, seems a great parable of what sin is all about. God gives us very clear rules, and we say, no, look, I know better how to run this show than you do. I'll tell you how to make the rules up. Eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's what it's all about. I am now going to be the moral arbiter of the whole world. It's my rules, it's my game, I'm going to do it my way. But the rules we make up are infinitely worse than the ones we've just discarded. The game is unplayable. And we constantly are having to change the rules to try and cope with the situation we find ourselves in. That is the great crime of deceit. That is what sin is all about. Let us take just the sin of deceit. We could pick on any other one, but let us take that one in particular. You see, I start off by deceiving myself, don't I? I now have to come to you with an image that it somehow will be acceptable to you. I cannot face up to myself as I am. For the things about me I find unpleasant, I try and pretend to myself that they don't exist. And I just live a fantasy world in my relationship to my own self. I won't face up to the fact that I am the slob that I am. Will not cope with that piece of information, and will constantly be pretending I am something other than I am. Because I cannot not only cope with myself, I cannot cope with you. I cannot cope with your assessment of me, because it is too close to the truth. So I will pretend to you that I'm not what I know I am, and what I think you think I am. And so I'll give you all kinds of other grounds to think I'm something else. And so as I move into some circles, I am tempted to drop all the names of the books I've read so as to impress you. Wear the kinds of clothes that will impress you. Listen to the kind of music that will impress you. do all kinds of absurd things just to impress other people, that I am not what I most clearly am, and any blind Freddy could work out that I am. And indeed I will even go so far, for sometimes you will be suspicious of me, that I'm not being completely the truthful with you, and you will ask a question, and I will outright lie to your face, rather than be found out for the sham that I am. And indeed it is not only with that, but it becomes then with reality itself. I know the truth, I know the facts, but I will not face up to the facts. I pretend they don't exist. And all kinds of things, like med students who smoke. There's a great absurdity about it, isn't there? They know the facts as better as anyone. Yet they will carry on with an action that clearly identifies them with stupidity. All due respect, nothing unchristian about smoking, just stupid, that's all. Lacks touch with reality. And indeed, there is that marvellous book by Michael Green called Runaway World, which he traces through the whole series of attacks on Christianity and demonstrates that the people who are running away from facts are not Christians, but the world. And I can testify over the years and years and years I've been talking to people about the gospel of Jesus, I can never find non-Christians who are willing to check up on the facts of Christianity, except a few have been converted. I find that people won't face up to the historicity of Jesus or the reliability of the New Testament evidences. All the evidence is available. They just won't look at any evidence. They'll keep on going on arguing with me about it, left, right and centre, but you ask them to start looking at hard facts, and they're not interested in that, because they live a life of a lie. And as Paul says, the ultimate lie they live is that they know God exists, but they suppress that truth, Romans chapter 1. And they pretend that it's not true, and will turn and worship anything and everything but the truth of God. I was interested in those philosophy of religion classes I took a couple of weeks ago at one stage. The lecturer said to me in one of the question times at one of them, he said, then what you're saying is that all atheists are immoral. Very perceptive of him, because that is exactly what I'm saying. All atheists are immoral. That is quite right, because they live a life which is a lie. They know there is God. That's why they spend so much time arguing against him. If you really were as atheistic as you wouldn't bother raising the subject. But they keep on raising the subject for a very simple reason they know is there, and it's a bit like me think the lady protesteth too much. They actually have to live a life which denies the very truth that they know. And their whole life is lived as a lie. And that, of course, is ultimately immoral. It is destructive of me, it is destructive of my society, it is destructive of any possibility of relationship with God. And it is a tangled web that I so tie myself up in that I cannot free myself from it. Jesus says, if you come to me and believe in me, and more, if you continue in me, then you will come to know the truth, and that will liberate you from all that sham and hypocrisy. That will free you from that hopeless bondage to always doing that which is wrong, trying to everlastingly cover up your tracks from other people finding out, from yourself finding out, from God, that he might find out, as if somehow he doesn't know. Free myself from that, and free from the death in sins. Free to have everlasting life. Life that is real. And he says, if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed. I don't care who runs this country in one sense of the word. It can be Mao Zedong, it can be Mal Fraser. In one sense, it doesn't matter one way or the other. Can't pick the difference. Because I am a free man. You can, Mao Zedong's dead. I am a free man. And the political tyranny I may be under is an irrelevance. For I am free indeed if I continue in the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now that doesn't mean, that's not to say, as Peter's question rightly pinpoints, that I do not from time to time go on living as if I were in slavery. I do. And each time I tell a lie, I am living in a way which is thoroughly inauthentic. I'm denying my very status. It's as if I've moved from, another illustration of the point, it's as if I have moved from Malaysia, growing up speaking Chinese, to come to Australia. And every now and then somebody asks me a question and I answer in Chinese. It's a throwback from my early youth, from long habit and practice, that I now still can, every now and then, think back into the wrong patterns. And what I must do is free myself of those aberrations and keep on speaking in the English in the new country. That is not really to equate Australia with heaven and Malaysia with the other place. Please make that clear for all Malaysians who are there. That is not that. But it is that kind of problem that I still may slip back into the old. But that is utterly inconsistent. I must do away with that. Now then, the freedom that is offered here really poses a couple of questions. Firstly, who is my father? That is the question. And every time I tell a lie, it poses that question again, doesn't it? Who is my real father? If I am to do the works of my Father who is in heaven, what am I to do? Well, I'm to hear the words of God. I'll hear it in Jesus. And I'll say, yeah, that's the truth. I know that's the truth. And I'll believe Jesus. I'll put my trust in him. But what is not on your outline is the most important point of all. If we believe in him, we must continue in him. Abide in him. Go on believing him. And as we do, so we will come to know the truth. And as we come to know the truth, so truth will liberate us from the bondage of sin, the bondage of lies, the bondage that leads and ties us down into death. Who then is your father? If you believe your father is God, because you believe in Jesus, then let me challenge you that you continue believing in Jesus, for you will come to many temptations to turn aside from belief in Jesus. But it is the one who hangs on to the end who is indeed the disciple of Jesus. If you do not believe in Jesus, you do not honour the Son, then you do not honour the Father either.